produced by Jeffrey Grisellius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast, episode 441. The Red Planet by Rick Wakeman and the English Rock Ensemble.
This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 441 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulryan, and co-host, Mark Anthony Kay, will be along a little bit later on. Please do get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on the site yesmusicpodcast.com. After speaking to Lee Pomeroy a few weeks ago about the new Rick Wakeman album, The Red Planet, we felt it was time to listen carefully to the record ourselves. As you will hear a little bit later on, both Mark and I rate it very highly. We also have time for a two pence, this time about Live Aid. Unfortunately, we're both a bit clueless about the event, so we will be needing your help and recollections, please. I also made another of my regular errors when I said that David Watkinson had recently shared some photos of Live Aid when it was, in fact, bassist extraordinaire Peter Greenwood. Sorry, Peter. Before all that, here's a quick roundup of the Yes-related social webs this week, starting with the YMP Facebook page. I posted a little animation of the full Union art print for everyone to have a go at naming all the Yes men contained therein, just for fun, and listen out for an update on the trivia cards in a few moments. Dave Watkinson added a week from his diary from 1984, where he did rather a lot of Yes-related things. He also includes his own photos. It's well worth seeing. Uncle Preston Frazier reviewed Solitaire from Fly From Here, and Mighty Miguel Falcao showed off his On the Wings of Freedom bass cover from that album I may have mentioned before, Tomato. Miguel's version is, of course, absolutely brilliant. Dave Fagan reminded us that it was Peter Banks' birthday this week, as did Dave Watkinson, who recalls meeting Peter just once. The aforementioned Peter Greenwood also posted a great little video where he explains the Rick O sound from a Yes perspective. If you haven't a clue what all that means, like I hadn't, then do watch Peter's excellent explanation of Chris Squire's bass sound. It's time for the Jeffrey Mason Visitor Posts Roundup for the week. This time we have a review of Steve Howe's Love Is solo album, some media from the 1974 US Tales Tour, a report of Bob Moog, or Moog, or whatever, visiting University of Florida, Rick Wakeman supporting the campaign to restore the Crystal Palace Bowl, a Red Planet review, a radio interview with Rick Wakeman, a Six Wives of Henry VIII review, another Love Is review, another Love Is review, an interview with Annie Haslam, where she speaks about writing with Steve Howe, a Billy Sherwood interview from this time last year, and finally, another Steve Howe interview. Doug Curran also added a 1973 radio sampler record, which includes Peter Banks and his Earthworks CD, which is signed by the band members. Adrian Bell's Progressive Alternative contains lots of goodies this time, including Soft as a Dove from Magnification. Over on Twitter, Brian Dilly spotted the ideal car registration number for a UK Yes fan, and the Rabin-esque blog has a new interview with Trevor Rabin. Miguel Falcao has created a Patreon page, and I'm proud to say that I've signed up. While Andy P pointed out that Mark and I kept saying Bellamy rather than Ballamy, or is it Ballamy? I don't know, last week. Sorry about that. Stephen Lamb also contacted me separately about that particular faux pas. Kenny Brown doesn't like Bill's machine gun snare on ABWH, but Prog Rock Kid thinks the album is as good as a lot of later Yes. Simon Barrow pointed us towards the jazz pianist who has the name Simcock, and whose first name I'm not even going to try to pronounce. He briefly joined Bill Bruford in Earthworks, apparently. So thank you to everyone who got in touch in any way this week, including the commenters on last week's show notes, Doug Curran, Ken Fuller, and Simon Barrow. Do go and read those because there's a lot more information on Bill and Earthworks there. This album has been produced brilliantly, including the packaging. I think the initial CD and vinyl editions of The Red Planet are limited, and after these are gone, the sleeves will be more normal. But for the moment, we're treated to a beautiful cover of an astronaut on Mars and in the gatefold, a pop-up version of the front cover. It's such great fun. The booklet is wonderful as well, with lots of real scientific data about the Red Planet and the missions which have already been there from Earth. There are photographs of the different topographic features which the pieces are named after, and great sleeve notes as well as some extensive branding, including a NASA-type mission badge with the names of the musicians on it, and an interior view of the spacecraft travelling around Mars. But what of the music? Here's the enigmatic tracklist. Ascreus Mons, Tharsis Tholus, Arcia Mons, Olympus Mons, the North Plain, Pavonis Mons, South Pole, and Valles Marineris. The first piece, Ascreus Mons, is named after a large volcano, apparently. The music begins with slowly changing repeated chords from Wakeman on what sounds like a church organ. However it's produced, it's very authentic sounding. The organ bass line moves in a slightly macabre fashion, and the general feel is fairly horror film-like. That's not a criticism, and as the drums and bass guitar join in, it's a very enjoyable mixture. Rick adds harpsichord for even more early 70s prog cred, and a synthesised trumpet plays a fanfare to mark the end of a section. The trumpet tone is the first very slightly unconvincing moment for me, but when you recognise the sound on repeated listening, it's not too annoying. The insistent beat on bass guitar and the general lack of movement makes this feel like an introduction piece, and it's highly effective as that. The synthetic choir works well, and there are plenty of enjoyable, memorable themes which spiral round for your enjoyment. It does sound like a science fiction soundtrack, and as the point of the album is to evoke a Martian landscape, that's highly appropriate. There's a fabulous old-fashioned heroic guitar solo towards the end, and a great rallentando to a well-crafted end. It's a great start to the album, which showcases just a few of Rick's trademark prog techniques, and the listener is left hungry for more. Already the production and instrumental performances are jumping out as stunning examples of their respective arts, and the high level of interest in this record looks like it might, for once, be justified. Tharsis Tholus is next, another volcano, but smaller this time. There's a fairly slow-moving synth flute solo at the beginning of this one, which goes through some interesting keys, and the accompaniment is appropriately relaxed, until a contrasting, faster atonal section slams into the flow for a few seconds. It keeps you wondering exactly where it's going to go. Some older material is then rocked up significantly with throaty guitars and big drums. Great stuff, topped off with a fantastic traditional Wakeman fluttering fast keyboard part. The music ramps up and up and then, praise be, there is the kind of Moog solo which Rick must have applied for and received a patent for in the early 70s. It's a blisteringly fast and exciting romp in exactly the way you'd always been hoping to hear from the maestro of the instrument again one day. The pitch is bent, the keys are a blur of notes, and the band beneath is clearly loving every second, just like me. I would certainly have bought the album just for this piece, and this section of this piece. This is why I think it's such an exciting moment for Yes, and its alumni at the moment. Rick here proves he's still the Grand Master of Prog, the Grand Wizard of the Mini Moog. If, like me, you've occasionally been disappointed with the length of Rick's Moog solos on Yes records, then you have to hear this. The music returns to the more laid-back feel of the opening, with its weird and wonderful haunting melody, and then ramps up again to the bizarre and progtastic ending. Wow. Double wow, in fact. Arcia Mons is the next geographically descriptive title. Another volcano. It's a bit of a theme emerging. This piece begins in a jaunty, energetic way with touches of full blown rock mixed in with a little melody on keys. Another huge build-up leads to a totally contrasting passage, complete with solo acoustic guitar in a beautiful oasis with Wakeman washes of sound and gently moving bass line. Lovely stuff. Then we're back to the opening rock fantasy, which brings a huge smile to my face. Keyboards are embedded inside the texture, which makes an effective change from previous pieces. It's almost Deep Purple inspired at times. Another oasis is reached and acoustic guitar plays a bluesy solo which is highly effective against watery sounding keys and restrained rhythm section. Certain to delight prog fans, an alternative texture makes an appearance towards the end with undulating and sweeping 70s synth tones. Another brilliant and engrossing piece. So what's the name of the next volcano? Olympus Mons. This one is very large apparently. This is the only piece on the album so far that I'm slightly less convinced by. It has a spindly-sounding main synth part to begin with, which for me plays a theme which is just tipping over into Joke Wakeman territory. It's a tiny bit banal. However, this is more than made up for by the following section, which features a great church organ or Hammond voice or a combination maybe. Unfortunately, we're soon back to the opening material, but at least there is a weird atonal part at its end. Another change takes us to a full-bodied rock segment with a significant pulling back in timing and a triumphant-sounding theme. A cinematic passage follows with another brilliant mini-moog solo from Rig. This fizzes away in fabulous style, a fine partner for the one in Tharsis Atholus. This is more bluesy in a way, but it's just as wonderful to hear before its pitch is bent downwards to allow a reprise of the first material, but this time with a much more enjoyable keyboard voice. It's a pity about that initial sound, because the piece is another winner apart from it. Large scale with plenty of rock and prog colour, topped off with quintessential Moog delight. We're now halfway through, and we get to travel not past a volcano this time, but across the North Plain. Very much a blend of 70s sci-fi keyboard lines, including slow-moving piano in octaves with synth cloister bell effects. It's an enigmatic opening, which does indeed evoke the image of a vast plain for me. Then suddenly we're driven headlong into a joyful Hammond organ and rock band passage, with lots of characterful organ from Rick. Chords give way to a simplistic but strong tune, and there's a great temporary hiatus or two in the motion of the music. Power chords introduce, guess what? Another mini Moog solo. Hooray! It's only brief though, and soon we're back to the opening weirdness and desert landscape. Perhaps slightly predictably, the Hammond passage returns, but when it's as fun as this one, I don't mind at all. Now, cowbell, plus stonking bass line doubled by guitar underpins more Hammond, and a joyful end is presided over by a Brian May of a guitar solo, which touches on more of an 80s hair rock approach at times, but is never less than scintillating. Crikey, another barnstormer of a piece, whatever next. Well, we're back to the volcanoes. This time it's Pavonis Mons. This one starts with a strut and a slightly goofy keyboard solo line. It's not too bad and the answering melody is fine, but it might annoy you in the same way it irritates my daughter. As we've come to expect, it does get repeated pretty soon. There are also some chordal parts which are a little bit melodramatic, but if you like Rick Wakeman's more expansive solo output, then you'll love this. Things are improved dramatically for me with some great piano, and by halfway through I've forgotten about the opening anyway, with solo after interesting solo on different synths, a lot of them showing off Wakeman's amazing dexterity and virtuosity, as usual. This piece is maybe not quite as strong as the others, but don't take my word for it, see what you think. I'm not the prog police, after all. Now, off to the South Pole. A snare roll introduces calm tones from Keys and the rest of the band. This turns into a pleasant tune using a flute-like keyboard sound. Guitar adds sliding atmospheric touches, and the music floats along in a very engaging manner. There is a change to a lovely solo piano section with washes of cymbal. Rick shows off his tender side, and as you'd expect, the piano work is sumptuous. Acoustic guitar joins in, and a flurry of descending piano notes takes us back to the feel of the opening. It's all very well constructed indeed, and works brilliantly in the context of the album. It is more towards the MOR end of Wakeman's output, but it steers well clear of silliness and banality. It's just good music, perfectly performed, recorded, mixed, and produced. Very enjoyable, as far-reaching bass lines jostle for position with the other instruments. Maybe the South Pole isn't the most memorable piece so far, but still well worth a listen. Finally, we reach the longest piece on the album, Valles Marineris, which is just over 10 minutes. Apparently, this is a system of canyons that runs along the Martian surface east of the Tharsis region. Okay. So, to be clear, this piece is highly and presumably deliberately reminiscent of Ravel's Bolero, at least at the beginning and end, in a bit of a mash-up with Holst's Mars, the Bringer of War from the Planets Suite. Guitar, bass and percussion start the whole thing off with a tantalising ostinato rhythm, and the bass line is superb as it writhes up out of the texture. There's a steadily growing sense of oncoming danger as the motion pulls a listener along and guitar takes up a riff. All the instruments then climb up high as if to a mountaintop to be followed by a passage which sounds like it could almost have been taken directly from Crises by Mike Oldfield. A more reassuring theme steadies the nerves with some effective synthesised trumpet and flute, which you will recognise from earlier on the disc. Various proggy segments are moved through, culminating in yet another fantastic sparkling mini-moog solo, and then a bit of a drum solo or feature, really. It's all really enjoyable, and interest levels are kept high by frequent and dramatic changes. Listen carefully for all the different instrumental variations and recapitulations. Most of the piece practically abandons the bolero rhythm, and maybe there are one or two more repeats than are strictly necessary, but it's undeniable that this is quality music. The bolero rears its head again right at the end, with what I think might be a direct lift from the classical piece, but in any case it's a great ending to a great collection of instrumental prog pieces. I'm delighted that Rick has managed to produce an album of this quality, and that he still thinks it's worth delighting the prog rock fans amongst us. While it's not exactly a rival to Close to the Edge, it's by far the most enjoyable Rick Wakeman prog I've heard in recent years. Now, I'm no expert on his output, but I know what I like, and the Red Planet will be spinning in my CD player a lot. In fact, it already has been.
Greetings, friends. So today we're going to be taking a look at Rick Wakeman's latest release, The Red Planet. Now, before we get started talking about this, I have to start this whole thing off by saying, finally, we have a Rick Wakeman album that shows his true strength as a musician on the keyboards. Now, many of us out there, and I know I'm not the only one, obviously, I've heard this from many people, we have been waiting long time for a progressive rock record from Rick Wakeman. One that would bring us back to the early days. Six Wives, No Earthly Connection, Journey to the Center of the Earth, you know what I mean. And for a long while, we've been getting nothing but albums like Piano Portraits, Piano Odyssey, Christmas Portraits, and don't get me wrong, I love Rick Wakeman and his piano playing. In fact, I'll go on record again, and I've said this numerous times, that Rick's greatest strength, I think, is his piano playing. He's just second to nobody on the piano. So of course, you know, making these kind of albums are not a bad thing. They're probably to his strength, and they've done very well for him. So why wouldn't he continue doing them? Piano Portraits was a number 6 record in the UK. Piano Odyssey was a number 7 record. So why not? But I think he's finally heard the calling of his audience loud and clear that it's time for a progressive rock record. And he has delivered this in spades, in my opinion. So let's do a little bit of technical background. This album came out on June 19th. Now, it was delayed several times, the physical part of it, but the digital copy came out, I believe, on that day. And the physical release followed on June 27th. Now, it was produced by Rick Wakeman, and the label that it came out on was a new label called R&D Media. Now, this label was founded by Rob Ayling, who is a music producer and works for distributor Gonzo Multimedia, which is a name that must be very familiar to people who buy Yes-related material. Mr. Ayling has worked with many people, including Pink Floyd, Yes, Level 42, and Asia. And his partner in this label is journalist-producer Doug Haar. He's a journalist. One of the books that he has written is called Rocking the City of Angels, which was released in 2016, and I believe he also has a tie to Gonzo Multimedia as well. Now, as I mentioned before, this album has been a long time in waiting. The last time we had a record of this type, meaning a progressive rock type record, was 2003 with Out There, which is one of my favorite records that he's done in the 2000s era for sure. This album has a space connection, obviously, to it. And what's interesting is that some of his other back catalog material, which I think are very strong, also have a sort of space connection. No Earthly Connection, for example, in 1976. And in 1993, he released 2000 AD Into the Future, which I thought was also a very good record and one that kind of gave hope to people even then that maybe Rick was going back to some of his more progressive roots. On this album, we have a very simple selection of musicians, meaning that there's only 3 others, including Rick, and they're people that are very familiar with Rick Wakeman releases. We have Mr. Lee Pomeroy on bass, David Calhoun on guitar. I believe that's how you pronounce his name. I could be wrong. I apologize if I'm pronouncing it wrong. And Ash Sloan on drums. Now, Ash Sloan, who may not be familiar with some of you out there, worked with lots of people in this industry, including Belinda Carlisle, CeeLo Green, and most notably, he is a member of The Producers, which is basically the Trevor Horn band, which is pretty popular in England, I believe. Also, he appeared on the 2017 Downs Braid Associate album, Skyscraper Souls, which was a very good record. And currently, I believe that he is he tours with Glenn Hughes, ex-Deep Purple. So he's a very busy man and has done lots of things within this industry. So he's an excellent choice to sit in the drum throne. Okay, now on to the music. So this album has 8 instrumental tracks. One of the things that I immediately liked about this record is the fact that it has quite the variation of instruments on here. Mainly, I'm talking from the keyboard end of things. We have lots of piano, B3, organ, mini Moog, Mellotron. I think that he finally put in all those sorts of instruments that we were longing for and put them into fantastic use on this album. Now, the record sounds very well done. You can tell that a lot of this was probably done at a, you know, big professional studio. Now that we are in the COVID-19 times, a lot of bands are being forced to do stuff at home. Now, that's not a bad thing because lots of us have fantastic studios to work with at home. But I think that Rick likes working out of big commercial studios. And from what I remember reading, because I followed Rick quite a bit on his Instagram and so forth, and his YouTube updates, where he was talking about the making of the record, they started the album in January and had the basic tracks all recorded for every song by February, I believe it was, by February 11th. So they got in right before studios had to start shutting down due to the COVID-19 epidemic, which is a good thing because all these other kind of overdubs and stuff like that are much easier to do in smaller home studios than it is doing basic tracks when you want to do the whole band with you. With when you have drums and bass and guitar and Rick's massive keyboard setup all in one room, I don't think there's too many people's houses that could probably accommodate that. So that worked out perfectly for them. Now, the bass and drum playing on this album is really fantastic. The connection between Lee and Ash on this record is really good. And probably one of the advantages of having a situation where they probably recorded in the same room together where they could have eye contact and see what they were doing with one another makes for a very strong rhythm section on here. I mean, you just have to listen to songs like Valles Marineris for a great example of bass playing and drumming together. Especially Lee's bass playing on here is just very well done. Very melodic, very technical, very progressive. I don't think there's been that strong a rhythm section on a record since maybe No Earthly Connection, but even then I think that this is stronger than No Earthly Connection from a musical perspective. For me personally, I love instrumental records, but I always tend to give more points to records that have vocals on it, so that's where No Earthly Connection may get a more tip of the hat in that regard. So this album starts off on a very high note with Ascaris Mons, which I believe is the way that it's pronounced. This is one record, though, I have to say, that I found very annoying trying to pronounce all the titles of this. I mean, besides the North Plain and South Pole, they're probably the only ones that are not a complete tongue twister to me to pronounce. So, of course, I won't be going through many of these songs, but I never do because usually I let Kevin go through all of the more fine details. But the first song, which I just pronounced and I won't try it again, is a great song, fantastic playing. Again, it has all the strengths of a great Rick Wakeman progressive rock record that we've been all waiting for. Great interplay between the bass playing and the drumming. Rick's keyboard playing is fantastic, and Dave's guitar playing is just fantastic on here. I mean, he has some great nods back to some of the older stuff on here, some acoustic guitar playing here and there on the album, but his lead playing is very, very good. The North Plain, for example, is another song that I thought was very well done, as well as the South Pole. They both have fantastic examples of good arrangements, strong bass playing, and the lead playing is very good on here. And of course, Rick's keyboard playing is very strong, some nice piano work, and a lot of Moog playing as well, which is something that I think is his strength as well. I believe I remember hearing him saying once that if he could be on a desert island and bring only 2 keyboards with him, one of them was obviously the mini Moog. So he tends to favor that instrument quite a bit when it comes to recording records. Now, another thing that I found very interesting about this record in comparison to some of his older releases, I find that as a whole, Rick became very generous on this record. And what I mean by that is usually Rick Wakeman likes to, you know, be the star of his show. Obviously, he's Rick Wakeman and the band is named after him. So he wants to be the one who shines. But I think on this record, for maybe the first time, maybe not the first time, but one of the rare times that he is allowed or that he's given his other members you know, more opportunities to shine. Dave's guitar playing on here has really had a chance to, you know, show its strength on here, I find. The lead playing is really good on here, and I know I've already said that a few times, but I can't help but stress it, because usually on some of his other albums, you know, there's a few minutes here and there where the guitar playing can do some lead playing, but it's never been something very memorable, in my opinion, and the tones have never been very strong. The guitar tone on this record is very good. We go also to Ash's drumming, and he has lots of times on this album where he, you know, has some stellar drum fills, and he even starts a few of the songs himself with some fantastic drum fills, and they kick in to the song. Now, that again, to me, shows that Rick is comfortable with, you know, letting these other people really step up and show their strength as players. And, you know, Lee, I mean, what more can I say about Lee Pomeroy? His bass playing on this album from beginning to end is just incredible. He has some great melodies on here. He can do some really technical things. And what I love about his technical playing is that it never becomes this sort of thing where you start rolling your eyes. You know, when you listen to an Yngwie Malmsteen album, for example, it gets to a point after like 20 minutes where you're like, okay, already, I've already heard this arpeggio like 100 times by this point. It's nothing like that when he plays. He has some really tasteful lines that he does, and they always complement the music and not just stand out like, look at me, look at me, look at how fast I can play, or look at how complicated a run I can do. They find a way to even make odd meters sound very enjoyable to listen to. And I think that's a really important thing to have in a time nowadays, because there's so much music out there. If you want to keep people's attention, you have to make it interesting and you have to make it memorable. Now, the last song, Valles Marineris, wow, I can't believe I said that correctly. That song, to me, I think is the highlight of the record. It is the longest song on this album, and I tend to like long songs for some reason. But anyways, the playing on this is very good. Again, it shows all the strengths of this band in one song. And I also find that I hear a lot of moments where it seems like they're tipping the hat to Holst's Planets album, because I'm a pretty big fan of that record. And throughout that Planets record, there are moments on here that I kind of hear on this record. Obviously, I'm sure it's an inspirational or an influential record to Rick. I would not be surprised in the slightest about that. So maybe this song is one of those ones where he kind of uses that inspiration to make the song even that much more stronger. So beginning to end, this album is absolutely standout. It's great that we have this record out finally. My one wish, and I know I mentioned this when we did the interview with Lee, is I'm hoping he can do another record like this, but maybe this time with some vocals. That would be really good. There's so many fantastic progressive rock singers out there now that could do a great job on music like this and make it even that much more captivating and fantastic, in my opinion. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed for a continuation down this road for Rick with these players as well, and maybe even bringing in a singer and continuing down the fantastic road that is progressive rock. And if you're listening, Rick, please, this record is a fantastic record. I give it easily a 10 out of 10. Keep going down this way and bring a singer next time. So let's go over to Kevin and we'll talk about this a little bit more.
We've both enjoyed Rick Wakeman's The Red Planet along with the English Rock Ensemble, and Mark is here with me now to discuss it further. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. And you?
Doing very well, actually. Rather rainy, but it's a nice day overall.
Good. Okay, then. So you, as a massive Rick Wakeman fan, as you said in your piece, but I'm just going to get you to repeat it, this must be a real delight for you to have something of this quality from Rick at his, you know, at his age, and let's face it, towards the end of his career, it must be. But coming out with something of this quality, good stuff, huh?
I was so pleased. You don't even understand. I mean, it was like I could literally hear like the Alleluia, Alleluia when I finally heard bits and pieces of this when it came out, because, you know, as I said before, we've been, as Rick Wakeman fans, like us real diehard ones, we've been suffering with a smile on our face, you know, to kind of not make it seem so apparent that we have to go through all these piano albums of late. You know, we're like, oh no, Piano Odyssey this, piano that, piano this, you know. Next thing you know, it's going to be like, who knows what other piano record he would have had next, you know.
Yeah.
So, but to come out with a proper prog album like this was just music to my ears.
Yes, absolutely right. And isn't it interesting that he decided to base it on The Red Planet? And I was thinking a bit about this after what you said about Out There, which is the previous one. That's also a space theme, No Earthly Connection, 2000 AD to the Future, which is not actually one I've heard a great deal about. And then I thought about Yes's connections to science fiction with Arriving UFO and Starship Trooper and space exploration and all that. Why do you think science fiction and science fact, so exploring other planets and so on, is such a common theme for progressive rock music?
Well, I think that it's a rather strong topic to use. I was going to say easy topic, but it's not easy. Nothing's ever easy when it comes to music. But I think it's a very imaginative topic. It's a very visual topic. Mm. You know, you can put up a picture of like deep space and Milky Ways and black holes and immediately come up with some kind of, you know, dark and brooding keyboard part, or come up with some like really heavy, you know, musical section for some, you know, explosion of a star, you know, like science fiction can invoke so many things in one's mind. So I think it's always been a popular topic.
Yeah, absolutely. But it is interesting, isn't it, that it seems to have been used so often in progressive rock music. When, if you think about the soundtracks on all the, at least the recent science fiction movies that I can think of, are very much more classically based. And, you know, if you think about Armageddon, for example, by Trevor Rabin. Mm. And, you know, that's a big box office film. So these are all these big box office science fiction films seem to have that classical connection. And, you know, Stanley Kubrick's 2001, with all that classical music in it, is very much more like that. I suppose if you go back far enough to things like Doctor Who in the 60s and 70s, they certainly did use electronic instruments and that was a huge link there. But not quite so recently. Now, what do you think about science fiction film music? Is that something that you're interested in yourself?
I do enjoy it quite a bit. Some of these soundtracks, I think, actually are probably more of the you know, ones I enjoy listening to the most. I mean, you know, I'd rather listen to an Armageddon soundtrack or some, you know, one like 2001 than listening to The Bodyguard or something like that, right? I mean, who wants to listen to, you know, a bunch of pop songs, you know? So, but I mean, if you think about it, the connection from science fiction to classical music has been around for a long time, as you said. I mean, one of the most popular examples of it is Holst's and the Planets album.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me is one of my favorite classical records, just because I think that the themes are so strong, the music is strong, and it also helps that a lot of the bands that I listened to through the years have sometimes connected to this record. Specifically, King Crimson did a cover of Mars on some of the earliest tours they did in 69.
Yeah, well, that's a great connection, isn't it? Because we have this Red Planet all about Mars and different places on Mars, I suppose, different mountains and plains and South Pole and all that kind of thing. And then Mars, the bringer of war, yes, from that Holst, the Planets, and into King Crimson. Absolutely right. And I suppose it's got something to do with the epic nature of progressive music and the epic nature of that kind of symphonic music that goes with those films that we've just been talking about. And someone like Ben Craven, who describes himself as a cinematic progressive rock artist. And the last song on this Rick Wakeman album, very much based on either the Holst, or I think it's kind of a blend of Holst and the Mars from Holst's Planet Suite, and also the Bolero from Ravel. Again, a massive, massive piece of music which requires a huge orchestra to put it on. So I suppose there is that aspect, isn't there? This is epic music in its scale, and that does sound like, you know, when you're talking about space, it's the final frontier, as they say. It's the huge expanses, and when you talk about exploring the moon or Mars or wherever, it's big. So I suppose that's one other link, isn't it? That's the epic music that we love from Yes and many other bands does lend itself to that kind of an epic science fiction treatment as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you think about some of the instruments used in progressive music, like, you know, a massive Hammond B3 with a swirling Leslie speaker, or you have like the ever popular Mellotron, you know, you can get those big strings to recreate the orchestra kind of parts. And, you know, there's just so much that this type of music can lend to that type of, you know, visual aspect and stuff. I mean, it's, I think science fiction has more to do with inspiration visually than it does anything lyrically. Because I can't imagine like some, you know, singer, like singer-songwriter, you know, singing about, you know, I don't know, the Milky Way clusters are so beautiful. Like, I can't imagine them like referring to something like that. Like, you know, the M3 comet racing by, you know, like it just seems like it's more to do with the visuals and what you get when you see these kind of things happening, like a star forming or something like that, than it is about actually something lyrically written. That's why I kind of thought about it when I thought about it further, that why didn't Rick, you know, use a singer for this? Because it probably would have been difficult to think of lyrics based around Mars.
Yeah, maybe that's part of it. And in a way, it is a bit of a shame, I suppose, that there aren't any vocals on this, as you've already said. And just going back to your lyrical thing, that's possibly why. So one of the reasons why so many people don't like Arriving UFO, because he does actually sing about aliens. And also why actually I find that song by Chris Squire called...
Oh, Aliens?
Yeah, so that's actually called Aliens. And I find the lyrics to that slightly jarring when he goes on about aliens are only us from the future and that kind of thing. So maybe it's easy to get a bit silly, I think, really, when you try and bring those science fiction aspects in. So perhaps he was right to stick to science fact and name all these pieces on the red planet after different parts of the real topographic aspects of Mars. So yes, good fun. So yeah, but it's interesting, isn't it? So tell me about those older instruments. You've already mentioned them, the Mellotron, the Mini Moog, and all those sorts of analog synthesizers, and even before synthesizers with the Mellotron and so on. That you can get lots of emulators now, can't you? I mean, I don't know the correct terminology. You'll tell me.
Yes.
So, don't they feel like prog? Why did Rick, or do you think he had to go back to those actual old machines to make this album sound like it does?
Well, I mean, for example, the Mini Moog. Okay, if you take a look at the display on it, there's a lot of knobs and buttons and stuff like that, faders and sliders and all kinds of things on there. And Rick is very much a hands-on Moog player. Like you always see him, he's doing a solo and all of a sudden his hand pops up and he starts turning something or twisting something or rotating something. Now when you have a Mini Moog plug-in on your computer, sure, it might sound like it, but it's a pain in the butt to grab your mouse and just try to get that little, you know, arrow over that one little thing and hope to God that when you go up and down with your mouse that it'll have the same feel than if you were to touch it with your actual hands. I think a lot of it has to do with that. I mean, all these great keyboards that he uses are very much like hands-on. Like even the Mellotron, you know, you have to make adjustments to it. The Hammond organ, there's a lot of, you know, those sliders you have to pull in and out to make adjustments. You have to turn on the Leslie, turn it off. So I think a lot of it has to do with, if you want an authentic sound, go to the real stuff. If you want to have, you know, an instrument that you can modify on the fly, you definitely need to use the originals.
Yeah. Interesting, isn't it, when you think about all those times when you see, for example, Patrick Mraz struggling manfully sometimes with some of the keyboards in the QPR footage that we've got, and sometimes it's not quite right, but then again, that was very difficult climatic conditions to play in at the time. And when I spoke to Tom Brislin, and he was going out on the symphonic tour, and he said that he wanted to use all the authentic old instruments, but I think the rest of the band were just much happier to have him standing there with a couple of emulator style keyboards, because it was a lot easier, I think. But yes, it does have that kind of tactile and analog feel, and perhaps those can only be got from those original instruments, and certainly it works brilliantly well here. And if, as I said, I think in my piece, if you're a fan of Rick Wakeman's Moog Mini Moog playing, then this album is absolutely brilliant. What are there, about 5, 6, 7 different passages where he flies away on that? And I don't know if anyone else, maybe you do, Mark, who plays it quite like Rick Wakeman does.
Well, quite like Rick, I don't think anybody does. I mean, he's the master of it. But I mean, you have like, there's a keyboard player in Spock's Beard. I forget his name again. He's an Oriental keyboard guy. Fantastic. He's really good on a Mini Moog. You know, sure, Geddy Lee dabbled with it a little bit here and there early on in Farewell to Kings and stuff like that. But, you know, look, Rick Wakeman when you think of Mini Moog, you think of him. I mean, like, if you go into the dictionary and look up Mini Moog, I think his face is beside that. So, but you know what? And again, you know how I am as far as the history of this band. If I'm going to say anybody plays the Mini Moog as good as him, I would maybe say Igor Korishev. He did a fantastic job with that sort of a style. But although he never used an actual Mini Moog, I think he just had like he used a few different Korg and Nord keyboards that had similar sounds to it. But he could probably do it justice as well, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. And I think Tom has also shown that he can do those sorts of things. It certainly sounds like it. Of course, Rick was the, you know, arguably the originator of a lot of these styles of soloing. So that's in abundance on this record, and I'm very, very glad it is, because I do love that when he gets going on the Mini Moog, it really is a fantastic feature of this album. So let's talk about though the bass, the guitars and the drums, and you were very impressed in your piece with those players, Lee Pomeroy, Dave Colquhoun, I do hope we're pronouncing that correctly, Ash Sohn, some absolutely fabulous playing. And as you said, I think that's really important, is that, as Lee told us, at times Rick said, play what you like in this bit. And they really did go to town, didn't they? And created some parts which are not just session musician filler type parts. They really are fantastic progressive rock parts, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned it in my part there that this album highly impressed me because of the fact that, you know, and look, I mean, it's Rick Wakeman, it's his album, it's his band, the feature should be on him. But this is probably one of the few records I've heard of his where he gave quite a bit of spotlight to it, the other members of this band.
Yeah,
I mean, Lee Pomeroy's bass playing on this is just absolutely fantastic. Yeah. I mean, I was very impressed with the fact that when they did complicated bits on there where he either, you know, did a unison with him or did a harmony with him, it never sounded like a complete, you know, like it wasn't like off the rocker. It was very melodic.
Yes.
It was, you know, smooth. It didn't sound like, you know, like I said before, like when you listen to an Yngwie Malmsteen record, by 20 minutes, you're like already had enough of that kind of, you know, arpeggios like crazy this and that. And blah, 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 blah. It's like they know how to make it sound listenable.
Yes.
That's the main thing I think that I love about it, is that they can do these different odd signatures and it all sounds really easy to the ear and just fascinating to listen to. And the same with the drumming on here. It's fantastic. And I mean, after I did a little bit more research and found out all these people that he actually drummed with, you know, it's not a surprise
amazing,
that he's such a great, great drummer.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you watched Dave's video on the making of this record, but one of the things that I found extremely impressive, and for all you guitar players out there, I think that you would find it impressive as well, is he used a little small Fender Champ amplifier for his guitar sound. I mean, when I looked around, like they had footage of his studio there, and he had all kinds of the best amplifiers. Like, you know, he had a Friedman amp, he had a, you know, he had Marshalls, he had all kinds of stuff, Vox amps.
Yeah,
he could have used anything, but he used this little small Fender Champ amplifier, single 10-inch speaker, I think, and he got that sound for his guitar. And I love the guitar sound. Usually the guitars are, you know, there on Rick's albums, but they never have the kind of guitar tones that I loved. But on this record, wow.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I think you're absolutely right also about the way that he allows the other musicians to be highlighted and solos and featured and so on. And I'm just wondering if the ARW experience had anything to do with that, because you can't play Yes music without the highlighting those other players, the drums and the bass, apart from ARW, so Lou Molino and Lee playing on stage with him every night. I wonder if he wanted to, or I wonder if Rick really thinks that for a proper progressive rock album, you need each player to be taking the spotlight at different times and to be fully integrated into the sound and not be just a backup player. And that was my only hesitation really with ARW. You may remember me saying that. So at the time was that Lee stuck at the back of the of the stage for most of the concert didn't feel like he was as integrated as fully as he could have been, but certainly didn't make this mistake. And perhaps that's one of Rick's features of proper progressive rock, that every musician is an equal member of the band.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, maybe it took, 70 albums for him to come to that realization, but I'm glad that he finally did, because it made for a much stronger album. Yeah. And again, I mean, to think of, if you really think about it, it's just three people and him, and they made that sound, and it sounds really good. Again, I can't help but stress too that I think they were extremely lucky that they got into one of those big studios and recorded their basic tracks together before they had to shut things down due to COVID, right? Mm. Because, it is a different thing when you're all sitting in the same room together, eyeing each other, even if it's just, the drums, bass alone in the room together. They have contact with each other. They can see what each other is doing. And it makes that much more solid a part together. And it really shows. I mean, it's a great, great performance between those guys. I can't help but keep stressing that, because, as a musician myself, I always listen for those kind of things, and it's just, when you hear it, it's just like something that you always get a great joy out of hearing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I do agree with Doug Curran. I think he said when he first heard the album that he was pleased that there wasn't a silly Wakeman song on it, or silly Wakeman piece. one of the comedy ones that he puts into a lot of albums, as we've discussed in the past.
Like a song like Fairies Are Real or something?
Oh,
like that,
yes.
Or,
the fairy, oh, yes, yes.
I'm So Straight, I'm a Weirdo or something.
Yes, all those ones. So there isn't one. So in a way, it's not really a more serious, but certainly there isn't that aspect of his comedy and humour in this album to the same extent as others. So that gets my vote, certainly. A really great album. We both really enjoyed it, as you can hear in how we've described it. And don't take our word for it, though, of course, as always, please have your chance on the show notes for this week to tell us what you think of The Red Planet. But certainly, it's definitely going to be one of my favourites, I think, for a long time. So, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
This is Two Pence with Mark Anthony Kay and Kevin Mulrine.
Mark's still with me, and we have a two pence, but this time it's from Mark himself. So, take it away, Mark.
All right. Thank you very much, Kevin. So, for all you listening out there, as you all know, we were talking online a lot, and lots of people were, about the anniversary of Live Aid, which happened in 1985. Mm. As we know, lots of fantastic bands made their appearances on there, but one band seemed missing at this time, and that was Yes.
Indeed.
From this. So, one thing that always struck my mind, and I guess this is a topic of our two pence, is why do you think Yes were not asked to play, or why didn't they play on it? Maybe they got asked, but why do you think they didn't play on Live Aid? It was 85. They were at the height of their comeback. They had just finished touring for 90125, and if they would have played, what do you think they would have played?
Yeah, okay, well, that's interesting, isn't it? Live Aid is one of those times in your life that everyone has a story of what they were doing when Live Aid was on. And I, unfortunately, my story about it is that, unfortunately, it was my school fete on Live Aid Day. And so, when Queen played, who were my favourite band at the time alongside Yes, I didn't see that live. I only saw it on repeat later in the day. But at least I saw it on the day itself. Some people did have, I think someone had a portable TV at the fete, so we kept looking in to see what was happening and so on, but I didn't see a lot of the of the daytime stuff. And I'm wondering if I'm just unaware of this. There may be a part in one of the books, and certainly someone listening today, I'm sure, will be able to tell us if they were asked and what happened and why it didn't happen and so on. But you're right, they were at the top of their game, and I remember Bob Geldof being asked, how did you choose the bands? And he said, well, there was only one criterion, and that was that they sold, millions of records the previous year. And so people would be interested in seeing them and coming to see them and giving their money, of course. So, Yes should have been there. Do you have any insight into whether they were asked or anything?
No, I don't actually. This is probably one of the principal reasons why I wanted to have this two pence, because I know that we have such a vast community of listeners and very knowledgeable listeners at that. So I'm hoping that maybe somebody within this community might have a little bit of a, you know, secretive information about what happened. Was there some big brouhaha, or was there something that, you know, Bob Geldof didn't like? Yes, or something, you know, who knows what it could be. But I'm very curious in it, because like you said, if the criteria was that they had to be a popular band that sold a lot, boy, I think 90125 very much qualifies that. And I think that they would have had a rousing, you know, ovation at Wembley for them.
So the second part of your question there, what would they have played, or what should they have played? And it reminds me of the fateful Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Would they, could they, should they have played the same songs as at that? And certainly they would have had to have played Owner of Lonely Heart. And a lot of bands, what did they get? Only a short amount of time, each band. So they would have had to have played that, as it, that was the hit from the previous couple of years. But what else? I'm not sure. Would they have stuck with the most recent material? I think they probably would. What do you think?
Well, I think they probably would have did, you know, Owner. I think they maybe would have did Changes. But I think one thing they probably would have did, and I mean, I know I've criticized this song quite a bit, is maybe they would have did Seen All Good People, because it's kind of a participatory song, which I can imagine seeing 70,000 people clapping along to would have been fantastic to see.
Yeah. I wonder how many people would have known it in that crowd. Who knows? It certainly would have been a great chance.
That's a good point.
I think they probably would have started with Cinema, though, because that's such an exciting way to start and go into Owner. You know, that would have been great, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think that would have been a great way to start the show. I mean, perfectly, because then they could have just, you know, had John do a big entrance after it was done, that 2 minutes, and, you know, the Owner of a Lonely Heart. I could see it now, you know, how he did it on the ARW tour, came out like, look at me, bask in my glory, you know.
Well, so, as long as he didn't try to do the same as on the ABWH tour, where he walked through the crowd that time. That I think that might have been a bit more difficult in Wembley on this occasion. Yeah. But yeah, they would have come out, I'm sure, as some of the highlights of that Wembley. I wonder if they were overseas at the time. Again, I'm sure there are lots of people who can tell us the answers, but certainly we would have liked to have seen them there. What about the US side, though? If they had been over there, is that a concert? I mean, I know less about the US side of things, except that Phil Collins went across the Atlantic, didn't he, and played in both. Famously, which was great fun. And did Madonna play, and various other people? What can you tell me about the US side?
I think at the US side, there was like a lot of American metal bands. I think like Judas Priest played at Live Aid. I believe, I'm not sure, because I keep wanting to say Duran Duran. Didn't they play in the US instead of in
may well have done,
the
yes.
UK?
We are showing our ignorance, aren't we? And it's really weird, because I've got a whole multi-disc collection on DVD of the whole thing, so I ought to get that out and watch it, definitely in tribute to this anniversary coming up.
Well, yeah, I mean, I find it totally fascinating, because I think when you think about them trying to bring all these fantastic bands in to do it, like we said, Duran Duran, Queen, you know, I mean, I remember they had Black Sabbath reform just for Live Aid.
That's right.
That was like they got Ozzy back,
yes.
Right? And I mean, you know, they had everybody and their brother who was of any kind of name play on it, but yet Yes didn't appear on there. That to me is just completely mind-boggling.
Yes, indeed. And The Who as well, they got The Who to reform, didn't they? And as much as they could. Deaths notwithstanding. Yep, so very much so. So let us know, I'm sure you do know. Now, Dave Watkinson was at the show, and he posted some photographs on Facebook recently of his view. I think it was Dave. Maybe I've got that completely wrong. But anyway, whoever that was, it was very, very interesting indeed to see those photographs from quite close to the stage. So, but if you have recollections, don't have to have been there, if you have recollections of Live Aid and know some of the reasons why Yes didn't perform, then please do leave those as comments on the show notes for this week's episode. Great two pence. Thank you very much, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Welcome to the Yes Music Podcast with Kevin Mulrine and Mark Anthony Kay.
Just before we go, here's the patron update. Half of the patrons are Aaron Steelman, Bob Martellotta, Brian Sullivan, Chris Bandini, Craig Estenes, Dave Owen, David Hayden, Lind, Dave Pannell, Dave Watkinson, Dem, Doug Curran, Fergus Cubbage, Fred Barringer, Jeff Bailey, Jeffrey Mason, Guy de Rome, Henrik Antonsen, H.B. Peterson, Ian N.B., Jamie McQuinn, Ken Fuller, Michael Handahan, Jim, John Cowan, John Holden, John Parry, John Thompson, and Barry Gorski. Also continued thanks to Robert and David. And not forgetting the Yes Music Podcast producers, Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. So thank you very much indeed to those patrons. And if you'd like to join them to help keep the lights on here at YMP Towers, then please do go to Patreon, patreon.com/YesMusicPodcast for the details. I did mention right at the start of this episode that I'd be giving an update on the Yes Music Podcast Yes Trivia Cards. We're almost ready to put these into production, so I should have some news very soon about that. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. I do hope we'll be back next week. But in the meantime, please do subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.